It's no surprise that updating the electricity grid today will make for a better tomorrow. Increased self-sufficiency is just one of the benefits. The Great Grid Upgrade will also boost the economy and create new green jobs. And best of all, you can continue doing the things you love, like watching the latest epic nature documentary or listening to this podcast while caring for the planet too. Find out more at nationalgrid.com.
This episode is brought to you by La Quinta by Wyndham. Your work can take you all over the place, like Texas. You've never been, but it's going to be great because you're staying at La Quinta by Wyndham. Their free bright side breakfast will give you energy for the day ahead. And after, you can unwind using their free high-speed Wi-Fi. Tonight, La Quinta. Tomorrow, you shine. Book your stay today at LQ.com.
This episode is brought to you by Smart Food Popcorn. Some decisions aren't the best, like skipping ahead in your favorite podcast. Think of all the banter you'll miss, the lore in the making. Luckily, Smart Food Popcorn is a no-brainer. Deliciously tasty and available in a variety of fun flavors. It's a smart decision every time. Smart Food. Add smart. To learn more, visit smartfood.com.
Hello, welcome to the podcast, which is the Nature and Countryside podcast from BBC Countryfile magazine. My name's Fergus Collins, and I'm your host. Today's episode, I'm meeting an amazing adventurer, traveller, and all-round superwoman, Phoebe Smith. We're going on a pilgrimage together because Phoebe has written a new book called Wayfarer, which explores how she found that going on pilgrimages, walks with a purpose, she calls them, saved her at a very difficult time in her life. So I'm very keen to find out, or to hear her story. We're going to start on a hill in the middle of the Oxfordshire countryside, and we're going to wander across the landscape, hopefully lunch in a country pub, and then finish at the gorgeous town of Dorchester upon Thames, the River Thames. So join me. Along the way, no doubt we'll find some fantastic spring nature, but I'm also really keen to hear about the power of the pilgrimage. Hello, Phoebe. Hello.
Hello, Fergus. Thanks for coming and joining me in the Thames Valley.
This is a great part of the world. We seem to be high up at the moment. Where in the world are we?
So we're above a village called Blueberry in Oxfordshire, and we're on sort of a bit of an old ridgeway, a high ridgeway. We're walking towards something called Churn Knob, or Churn Hill.
Churn Knob, okay.
Yes.
Excellent.
Which they think was some kind of burial mound. But then its Christian links come into play around 635 AD when a guy called Birinus, who was a monk sent from Italy, he was sent by the Pope to convert the pagans to Christianity. And he was supposed to go up to kind of the Midlands. And before he got there, he was disgusted, apparently, with what he found here. And decided this is where his work would be. And,
my goodness.
And so, this spot where we're headed is where he is said to have convinced and converted the king of the Saxons to the way of Christianity.
So this is going to be very interesting because this is the start. There's a religious theme, but it's not religious. But we're talking about pilgrimage today, aren't we? We're going to go on a pilgrimage.
And we
this is the start of a pilgrimage. And... well, it's really the theme of your book that we're going to talk about as we wander along.
Yep.
And I want to talk a lot about what pilgrimage is and what it means and, you know, why people go on them and that sort of thing. But what is this particular pilgrimage about then? So is it to do with this Italian...
So this Italian monk who then became known as St. Birinus.
Yeah.
Who founded then the abbey in Dorchester on Thames, which is where this one ends. So this is a micro pilgrimage.
Only 12 miles.
Only 12 miles, so you'll be fine. Back in the day, around, they say, especially the sort of 12th century, pilgrimage would have been in its height.
Yeah.
Especially here, and especially Dorchester. And they would have done this route from the spot where he kind of saw the light, as it were, and then walked there.
We're going to take shelter behind some sparse trees before heading out to see
this knob. Yeah, so They would have done the walk from the place where he saw the world of God down to Dorchester, where he'd formed his abbey. But during the Reformation, around the 1500s, or maybe 1535, of course, that was all, you know, put paid to. The abbey was going to be destroyed, but a rich man bought it, which is what preserved it. And then it started up again around, I think they said around the 17th century, there's records that people must have walked this and gone through all the churches in the village, so they would have stopped along the way for shelter.
Amazing.
Yeah.
So we're going to do that as well, I hope.
We are, yeah. We'll see what's open, because things are different now.
it's a early March day. It's actually sunny, but as you can hear, it's a bit breezy on the top. We're on a kind of chalk downland here.
So
which county are we in? Is this
This is Oxfordshire, but parts of it are on what were historically the Berkshire Downs.
Yeah.
So it's
Oxfordshire's stolen bits of Berkshire, hasn't it? It's
basically
been a bit annoying that. I think it's always a bit rude. So this tump, it looks to me like a burial mound. I like a nice burial mound
of
on
course.
The podcast, but was sort of mysterious who was buried here. But it's got other significance then. It's this place where this monk preached his first sort of...
Yeah, and convinced the king to obviously convert to Christianity, which then converted the people. And, you know, I should say here, because I'm not religious at all, but there's something about these stories I absolutely love, and something about pilgrimages, which I love. And, you know, you mentioned my book before. You know, the journey I went on started by doing the most famous pilgrimage, arguably in the Western world, the Camino de Santiago in Spain, and completely losing my way in life and realising I had to change everything. And dealing with past traumas, dealing with abusive relationships, I needed some kind of tool to help me navigate things. And that magical tool turned out to be pilgrim trails, like this one.
That's incredible. Well, that gives us me a really... I mean, the book, I've read the book, is incredibly honest. And it's brilliantly written.
Thank you.
It's... As I said to you in an email, I was sort of breathless at times with how honest you'd been, and kind of all the better for that. I know it must have been incredibly painful to write, I suspect, or maybe cathartic, I don't know.
I'd say a bit of both. Yeah. There were, I think, both doing these pilgrim paths was painful and cathartic, and both writing, you know, there were times where I was crying, there were times when I was laughing, but I think throughout it all, what pilgrimages gave me was that sense of hope. Because they're all, as you've heard from the dates, they were our ancestors walking these routes, trying to make meaning. They were people trying to make sense of their lives, of the world, of their place in it.
So exactly the same way you were.
Exactly. Yeah. And as I learned about the pilgrimages and connected, I was never interested in history, right? Which I know sounds silly with all that I'm talking about.
You're talking to a man with a history degree.
But it's because the way I think I was taught it in school, it was very male. Women didn't get much of a...
Tudors and Nazis, was it?
Basically, yeah. And as a woman, you know, you got beheaded or you weren't involved. So, you know, you stayed at home and had to deal with all that fallout. So I wasn't really that interested. But then actually learning about the religion part of it, I suddenly realised religion and history are so connected, that loads of places around the UK are connected because of this history that was so intertwined with religion. And as I started connecting the dots between those and the pilgrim routes, which you'll soon see they all link to each other, it helped me start to create a map almost in my own head to link together things I'd been through and my own histories to be able to understand and find a way forward. So, yeah, I think they're a magical network that connects us somehow to the past.
Amazing. I really want to explore some of that as we walk along.
Lovely.
We've got 12 miles. We're going to cover a lot of ground. So we're climbing up onto the this mound, which has a sort of weird star lamp post.
Yes,
forgive
it does.
The wind up here.
It's very, very windy.
And the pole is rattling in the wind.
It really is.
There are a few nettles up here. It's a burial mound. It's a sort of Bronze Age barrow or something like
it
that.
It is, definitely. And there was actually a wooden cross up here that one of the churches decided to put up, because from this spot,
it's an amazing view, isn't it?
And he said he could see his entire parish. So he was like, I'm going to put the cross here. But obviously he didn't get permission. This is a scheduled ancient monument because it is a burial mound. So it was a case of... you can't put that up. So for ages it was lying on the floor, but it seems to have gone now.
Oh, what a shame. I mean, we should just say the view here is 360, well, almost 360 degrees, apart from the sort of behind us where there's a clump of, like one of those sort of beach hangery type things, but the rest is vast agricultural fields. We're walking along, it's a kind of, well, it must be quite an old track, this, I imagine, but it's like a raised track, running slowly off the hill down into Blueberry, the village. But you can see there's little signs of spring along here. There's a few celandines and some cuckoo pins, and kind of heartening. Phew.
It's finally coming.
It's amazing, isn't it, how it does come back. Yeah.
But you know what? That's what it's almost a bit, and this is going to make me sound very, I don't know, but you need the winter to appreciate the spring, right? You need it all going away to suddenly notice it coming back, which is quite metaphorical.
No, I think you're right. I think you're right. We kind of need to, I'm almost saying you need the bad times to appreciate the good, yeah?
Definitely, okay. Definitely. You see where I'm going.
Well, as I say, your book is, you know, you are very honest about your bad times and quite heartbreaking, some of the stuff you've been through. You're a well-known travel writer.
I mean, yes.
You've been a travel writer, you've travelled the world. The last thing you said to me, you'd been wild camping in Saudi Arabia.
I was, yes. I just got back last week from doing that. Yes, I like to, if a country says they're open for tourism, I like to really push it to make sure they are. so yeah, but I was on the Camino de Santiago on assignment for my readers. So I was there, and as a travel writer, yeah, that's what you're often there for someone else. And you write about the world for someone. You're the eyes and ears on the ground. And I did it thinking I had everything together. And, you know, I met this, it's really, really strange, serendipitous thing. I met a father and daughter duo who had, he'd retired and she was walking with her dad. And they were so in tune with each other. And there was this such mutual love and respect. And it triggered something in my head, I think, back to my childhood. And, you know, I left home around the age of 17 under a bit of a cloud. And then a couple of years later, my mum died. And I feel like I've always been trying to get back. I never managed to reconnect. I never got that connection. And, you know, through various toxic relationships myself, abusive relationships that I've been through, I suffered with an eating disorder that I didn't really realise I had, and had a very sort of difficult relationship with my dad, who went on to another relationship quite quickly.
After your mum died.
After my mum died, yeah. And the woman was not very keen on me, and I was obviously not processing my grief. And I think something about it triggered me to start remembering these things, and it was very uncomfortable for me because I think I dealt with things, as many of us do, by compartmentalizing them and pushing them down. And something about seeing all these pilgrims who were doing this to, you know, as a triumph, finishing a pilgrimage is a wonderful feeling. I hope you get it later, because when you've achieved this, you know, it's this wonderful...
We'll raise a glass in Dorchester.
You know, it's a wonderful feeling to finish something. And when I got to the end of it, even though I wasn't there as a pilgrim, and people would greet me as a pilgrim with the Buen Camino and, you know, have a good walk, and I felt like a cheat. I felt like... And I don't know why it bothered me
so
much.
That was intriguing. You felt, yes, because I made a note. It felt like a cheat doing it.
I felt like somehow a cheat amongst all these other people, and especially compounded by the fact that I didn't feel free at the end. So I finished it. So you go to the cathedral.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning. You go to the cathedral at the end, and they swing what they call the Butter Fumero, which is a huge incense disperser. So,
I've seen that. It's like a kind of great
It goes up to 40 miles an hour, swinging through this huge cathedral. And and you could see, look around me, the faces were so joyous, tears of joy. You know, people had had epiphanies. And I just felt nothing. And if anything, I felt sick. And I knew there was something wrong. And when I left, I just knew something had to change. And that, I think, was the moment, the catalyst that I knew something had to change. And funny enough, a year after from that trip, I got offered to go and walk on a newly rediscovered pilgrim path down in sort of Kent with the British Pilgrim Trust, who were a charity that set up a few years earlier. And they'd found this old map, the Gough map, which they think is the oldest map that exists. And on it, they'd found a route which appeared to be one of the first pilgrim paths that went to Canterbury. A real moment for me came when we went into a church and they led a song, and it wasn't a particularly religious song. It was a bit like a folk song because one of the founders was a former wandering minstrel. So he would find these old folk songs, and everyone was just joining in, whether they could sing well or not. And I couldn't. And I was back in the day a singer in a band, and I suddenly was like, I can't even sing anymore. But suddenly realizing I'd lost something that was quite fundamental to my youth, how I survived going through leaving home and dealing with all the things that entailed, and the, you know, the trauma and relationships that brought up, was very powerful to me. And I suddenly thought, wow, I've become a pilgrim again, and all very much by accident, yeah. The accidental pilgrimage.
We're just passing badger set after badger set here. We've got the path we're on has just got these steep banks. It just feels like one of those holloways that
definitely
spooky things happen in, although it's a really sunny, benign day now.
I know, it doesn't feel that spooky here, does it?
But no.
But yeah, when they kind of decided to bring this pilgrimage back, they looked on maps, read old accounts of it, and they do think this was the path that they took.
This was the actual
So, I mean, looking at that, has definitely been worn down by many boots.
Yeah, I love that, the way that these holloways through boots and by running water or whatever, they just become hollowed out.
Yeah.
So what a lot of people will say, oh, it's just a walk, isn't it, Phoebe? What's the difference between a pilgrimage and a hike and a long multi-day walk, as those who work in travel writing talk about?
Well, you know, for me, it's that it feels like it's got to have a purpose to it. And I think because someone chose it as a reason that someone could make meaning from, that makes it a bit different. I suppose it's got a reason for doing it and for doing the whole thing, a reason to start somewhere and end somewhere rather than just an arbitrary, this is a good place to park your car. The thing with pilgrimages, people, it's kind of almost got confused over time. People think they have to be religious, and they're not. Some pilgrimages, there's one called the Old Stones Way up in the Peak District, you know, and that's pre-Christian. That's really nothing to do with it. There's one in Avery, obviously,
yes,
that way, which we all know predates that.
Processional routes.
Yeah. And of course, a lot of churches were built in locations that were already important to the pagans, and that was all linked to the natural world. So a lot of them were built next to a spring or a well, because of course you're, as a pagan, you're celebrating life. So they were appropriated because you're trying to convince a whole population of pagans to believe in something else. So that's why the churches went on holy sites from that time. But I think anything can really be a pilgrimage. You know, we were talking before about you going in search of a bird you're trying to see, or someone might go to see an old ruin or the source of a river, say.
Yes, that's a common one.
Yeah, and I just think it's that, it doesn't matter what the links are, it's that purpose. And you set yourself something you're going to find and somewhere you're going to start to do it.
Here we go, we're crossing a chalk stream.
This is
here.
The chalk stream.
Yeah, crystal clear, sort of gravel bottom, very, very beautiful. Looks kind of tasty and unpolluted.
Yeah, it does.
Let's leave it there.
Yeah, let's hope.
Yeah. So we're sort of going through the village of Blueberry and then heading out across the Oxfordshire countryside.
Yeah, towards the next village, which would be South Morton. Because of course, pilgrimages, they always wanted to go through places you could stop for refreshments, or places that offered refreshments would be built up along a pilgrim route. Because if you're someone who has a business, yeah, I want to go where the people are. The people are walking these routes. Let's serve them.
That makes a lot of sense, isn't it? So, yeah, the watering holes, literally, will be.
Yeah.
And there's a church.
You can hear the church bells go in.
The bells are ringing.
So every year until COVID, I think from around the 70s, they would do an event pilgrimage on this route.
Yeah.
Every year. So do what we did, start at Chernob and end at Dorchester. And every church you went in, you could get a stamp in your passport. And that's, even though St. Birinus's feast day is, I think it's 5th of December, it's in the winter, apparently there was a record of, I think in the 17th century, someone asking the Pope if it was okay to celebrate it in midsummer, so the weather was nicer.
Yeah.
And it was agreed. It's like, yeah, sure, why not do that? So people would have been walking this route and doing that, and it was a real, I never managed to do it, but it was a real community event. There are pictures you can see of everyone coming together, volunteers offering refreshments in the churches, people getting their stamps. But sadly, COVID put pay to that, so it's no longer done as a group event thing. But yeah, so this is the first church.
Beautiful little church.
Yeah.
The squat tower. And squirrel running through the gravestones, and a wren giving us a good blast.
A nice song, yeah.
You can hear we're serenaded by whistling red kites. Gosh, it's going to be really interesting if we get red kites whistling all the way through today.
I'd be surprised if we
didn't. I hope you can
pick
that up. So we're on a chalk track leading up slowly onto, well, we couldn't really call it a hill, but can you hear the skylarks have come up around us?
Beautiful.
They're just lovely. A good skylark here so far. But although you live here now, this sort of chalky Berkshire, Oxfordshire landscape, Wales seems to be homeland. Where is homeland for you?
Yeah, that's a very difficult question. And I think that's part of the thing I was working through, is that, so I was born in England, so by birth England, and my dad was from Kent, my mum was from Derby, and but I, when I was about three, they moved to North Wales, and so really that's Wales was what I knew. And you know, I say I didn't go to school, I went to Ysgol.
Do you know what this hill is? It's got some ridges cut into it.
This is Blue Burton Hill, and it is an old fort.
Ah, okay, so it's a hill fort.
Hill fort, yeah. 110 metres, so like you said, we can't really call it a hill, but
no,
in the grand scheme of things...
it's towering over the surrounding countryside, but it would be a prominent defensive position. And you can see from quite a long way away the ridges.
Yeah.
It's a lovely thing.
Yeah, it's still there, still prominent.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, so yeah, so Wales very much felt like home. But then, as I said before, you know, I left home when I was a teen and kind of went from sofa to friend's house to wherever and really struggled to sort of find my way.
You were a wanderer.
Wanderer from then,
from
a wayfarer,
age.
If you will.
Well,
from
that's the name of your book. We yeah, wayfarer.
Yeah.
So you've always been a wanderer.
I think so. I think since then, and in a funny way, I've been wandering all over the world, you know, as an adventurer, as a writer, you know, campaigning for everyone to get this access, because I've really found a sense of healing in the outdoors, but always trying to maybe find a way home and not really sure where that is. And I think I say in the book, you know, when I walked the North Wales Pilgrim Way, so this was many years after my mum had died, and I'd quit my job, I'd quit a long-term relationship, and I decided I needed to do a proper pilgrimage. And the North Wales Pilgrim Way just made sense. It was the places it passed through and visited all had some kind of connection to my childhood. So it was like someone had kind of mapped this spiritual quest just for me. And I thought I have to do it. And there was this moment on it where I got chased through a field of cows.
Yeah.
And I talk about how that, you know, we're always told you don't run, you stay put, they're not really that dangerous.
Yeah,
or,
yeah.
And I just...
Until they are.
Until they are. Yeah. And it was kind of a turning point because it made me suddenly realise on many levels that what you've always been led to believe is not always necessarily right. Mm. And perhaps you do have to do something you didn't think you would. We're going to cut up the side here.
Off the hill fort.
Yes, I'm sorry, there's a gate there, see?
A bee just went past. I love a good hill fort.
Good.
I was interested in a couple of things there. Obviously, this idea of searching for home.
Yeah.
Do you think you found it now? I mean, we could say that when we get to the end, but I mean, has this quest, this pilgrimage obsession, maybe? Is that too strong a word?
I don't think you really ever end a pilgrimage, is
right.
Probably my thing. I think...
Well, that's interesting.
You physically end
a
pilgrimage route, but do you ever really end... The search for meaning, I'm not sure you do.
Yeah.
So when I started to get into the outdoors as an adult then and start to really understand where you could go, and you know, mine was through the mode of wild camping, and in a funny way looking back now, it was, you know, various relationships I was in, it was almost an escape. It was the outdoors was almost like a medicine to escape everything.
Yeah.
And to escape that chaos. And that's why access is so important. I mean, even then, as a God, when I probably would have been early 20s, you know, people told me I couldn't or shouldn't go into the outdoors on my own because I was a woman. And so there were already barriers put there that even as an adult, suddenly, who now could afford the kit and could read a map, you know, I also work a lot with a charity that I set up, which works with underprivileged young people, because again, I think class is a massive barrier to the outdoors. Even if you've set aside the gender, like women shouldn't go out walking on their own, kit, it's expensive, where do you go, knowledge, you know, even if you set all that aside, the key thing then is that you can actually go. It's the access. We already know that public transport is a real problem of getting people from inner city out to these areas. And so even you say you remove that, they've got to have somewhere to go. And we can't all just be going to the same place. You know, the Countryside Rights of Way Act, when it came in, was hailed as this landmark thing, which, yes, at the time it was. It was opening up swathes of the countryside that had been formerly closed to us. But it was only certain types of countryside. And some of them created these access islands.
I've seen those on maps, the little yellowed areas on
You can't get to legally.
Yeah.
Or, you know, there's a permissive path. And, of course, the permissive path means it can always be removed.
Yeah.
So suddenly you can't get there. There's a classic one in the Peak District, Crome Hill and Parkhurst Hill.
Oh, which are the famous sort of like dinosaur back hills.
Beautiful, the most beautiful. You can see them as a reef that they would have once been under the water. Like, you can't actually link them in a walk. They're both access ones, but there's a kind of a funny, if you look on the OS map of it, you'll see you're reliant on permissive paths. Yeah. That's an issue. And so when there's this argument for removing access or tightening up access or these initiatives coming to charge people for wild camping so that it should be free, it really riles me because I know there's already so many barriers to getting people into the outdoors. And, you know, we recently saw the case with Dartmoor, with the Darwals, who yeah. own a land that's bigger than the size of Gatwick Airport, just to contextualise that. Yeah. And I remember being asked to speak about access on the Jeremy Vine show, and someone who'd bought property in Dartmoor National Park, knowing full well when they bought it that there was a right for people to roam and access, suddenly said, well, how would you like someone coming to camp or walk in your garden? And I was like, my garden's not the size of Gatwick Airport or the size of Gibraltar. Like, and also, do you know what? I probably wouldn't really mind because yeah. I just getting people out there.
I think that's such a cruel argument and yeah. so utterly distasteful that someone who owns vast swathes of land thinks there's any equivalence between, I mean, I feel lucky and I've got a 40-foot garden max.
Nice, you know, but some people have nothing.
Some people have nothing. And I wouldn't want people coming into my garden, but people have done. But, you know, it's a garden. It's a proper, you know.
It's a private thing.
It's a fenced little garden, clearly attached to my house. It's not a vast way of punch. Now I'm getting all riled up now, and I'm the interviewer, but it's...
Well,
I've heard
this
argument many times.
It's always the thing thrown at you. And, and the thing is, if you look to Scotland, who, you know, they had the Land Reform Act coming in, which said everywhere is available for people to access unless you can find a reason it shouldn't be.
Yeah.
The Crow Act was the opposite. It was like, these ones can be accessed, but don't worry, if you say it can't be, we'll look at removing that. Yeah. It was very much done that way round.
From the landowner's perspective.
From the landowner's perspective.
Than the other
and, you know, we've now got... What, 20 years of Scotland having their right to roam, showing that it does work. People aren't camping in people's gardens. People aren't walking through people's gardens. Yeah. You know, it's such a baseless, reductive argument. Yes, through here.
I mean, obviously Scotland, which in context, Scotland has a lot more land, a tiny population yeah. across a huge area, compared to England, which is... Well, actually, we're walking through completely empty countryside here.
Yeah.
Yeah, we are crossing a road now, but I think that there's this image that England is completely paved over and it's all... We can walk for miles now.
Yeah.
And not come across... Well, we are going to walk for miles and not really going to come across anything apart from tiny villages.
Yeah.
And now I know you spend a lot of money on your land, you're a farmer, these things are important and you don't want people trampling your crops and access... I'm putting to you comes with responsibility.
100%, and that's where we've become so disconnected from the land, haven't we?
Yeah.
And so disconnected from the place where we live, and there's all these rules and regulations, and they all exist for a reason. But let's start teaching kids, let's empower the kids in schools to know the countryside code. Let's take them out more for lessons and get them to understand why, not just don't do that, why we don't do that, what it could hurt. Get them to fall in love with the natural world, because I guarantee once you get someone to fall in love with it, they want to protect it. That's the key to conservation, to looking after nature, getting people to fall in love with it. And I think for me, going back to the pilgrim route and the wayfaring, is that it's about that making connection. And I think even when you look back to when pilgrimages were in their height, people were much more connected. People would just go, you couldn't be a rambler back then. It was a difficult life, but people still knew they had rights to walk from one place to another, to meet new people, to experience the world outside their own doorstep. And that got taken away by Henry VIII
and enclosures later.
Yeah. You know, it all this kind of links back to that thing. And that's why I think part of the reason I wrote the book was to tell people about this network, showcase that you don't have to be religious to tap into it. It's completely free. It's out there to find, they're out there to walk. And it does reconnect us. It's all about that reconnection again that helps us connect with ourselves as well and what we've maybe been through. And there's nothing quite as freeing as knowing I have the right to be here. And that goes to anyone. I would not still be here with you now had I not tapped into these pilgrim routes, I don't think.
That's so I've read the book. But yeah. Can you elaborate, if you're happy to elaborate on that?
Yeah, so yeah. Things got really, really dark for me, and I was prepared to take my own life. I went outside with a bottle of whiskey and some pills, and I went and climbed a hill and sat on the top, and I just wanted it all to stop. I didn't think I was adding any value to the world, and it would be much better if I wasn't in it. And I sat there, and you know, I could hear an owl in the woods, and just everything was going through my head. And I happened to be stopped randomly by someone who I'd only spoke to a few times on social media. She was a influencer who was all about empowering people to get outdoors as well. And she hadn't heard from me for a while, and she just called
just
out of the blue.
Just at that moment?
Just to see if I was okay.
Oh, my goodness.
And if she hadn't, who knows? And yeah. And since then, I knew I needed to get help, which was through counselling.
Yeah.
And, you know, and medication as well, antidepressants. But also, I needed to make time for myself to be able to make sense of what I was going through, but what I'd also been through. And I think that's the problem. We're so much caught in this cycle, aren't we? Of fast pace, making money, doing, like...
Paying the
bills. There's often very little time to give ourselves space. And for me, tapping into that network, and bear in mind, as an adventurer, I'm so used to ploughing my own way, getting a map, working out my own routes, finding my own, why am I going from here to here? Suddenly there are these routes that I know that hundreds of thousands of people have also trod to make that meaning. And it just worked for me.
Perhaps felt the same as you.
Exactly.
Did you feel that then, that you'd...
I definitely felt...
Yeah.
And you know, like you said, when we were walking back at the Holloway, you could see physically that boots have worn that down.
Yeah.
And you think, why were people going on pilgrimage? Well, they were trying to make meaning. They were dealing with hard times of their own. And that probably gave them a bit of an escape from everyday life. It got them to...
Spirit of... Right, I see the red under... It's so close.
So close, isn't
white
it?
White sort of flashes under
wings. It's not whistling
black.
For you.
No, the kite is just drifting along.
We might come back.
We've been pinned in here, actually, haven't we? The footpath has been pinned in against between two hedges. It's not at all unattractive. I mean, very brave of you to reveal all of that. But, you know, it was a lucky chance that someone got in touch.
It was, and I think... Especially with this book, it's something I reveal a lot. Like you said, it's very honest, very raw. And I am denied about what to do. And when I was sitting down to write it, I thought, well, I can either just gloss over all of it, or I have to bare my soul, if you like.
Yeah.
And I went for the latter. And I suppose my hope is that, you know, coming to talk to you now is to say that this network does exist and it can really help. You know, walking these pilgrim paths, it's not just about beautiful scenery and doing a lovely walk. You know, some of the people that you meet are incredible, and you hear their journeys and hear their stories. And again, I think we have this, we kind of sequester ourselves away and don't share that we're going through these bad times. You know, maybe that's changing with the next generation.
But I think we don't want to bore our friends with our problems
quite
a lot of the time.
But actually, do you know what? When I started to tell people something was wrong, they would tell me something was wrong too. And actually, no one wants to admit they're going through something. And everyone's going through something. There's always something more going on. And I suppose if by writing the book I can help someone who's either currently going through it, been through it and is trying to process it, then it's worth revealing all these painful details and showing the hope as well that is definitely there.
Church just through the
yes,
that's our second church. Who knew? There are lambs here. These are the first lambs I've seen.
Yeah, me too.
It's jackdaws as well. They do like to hang around the lambs.
They do.
Actually, that does lead to the question of how do you find the time to go and walk these? I know that you're a freelance writer,
yes,
but you're a mother of a young child.
Yeah,
you've got deadlines,
yes,
responsibilities. There's a whole load of things you're committed to.
You know,
how?
I think it's been a long, long lesson to learn that you have to factor these things in as one of your things you have to do.
Yeah.
I am saying this as a woman who for many years struggled to do that. So I know how hard
Did you
that
have,
is.
Like, the people around you stopped you, or was it your life was just not in that right place, or was it yourself that was stopping you?
I think it was a combination of all those things. I think each one was connected to the other. Again, this connection. I think I've been in quite controlling and abusive relationships that had made me think I didn't have that kind of, I don't know if authority's right, but that agency is probably a better word, yeah, to allow myself to do these things.
You felt you owed them your
time. I felt I owed them, and then that then probably translated into work, that their deadline was more important than something I wanted.
Oh gosh, yes.
I think
a lot of people would recognise that. Actually.
I think so. You internalise that, and you put so much importance on other... And I mentioned this in the book. I think a lot then stems back to when my mum died, and I say how whether families mean to do this or not, it feels like, especially as a girl, you're made to feel like you have to be the dutiful daughter. Your happiness is less important than making sure everyone else is happy. And before mum died, she said, "You'll be okay. You'll be okay, Phoebe. I'm worried about your dad and your brother." And that was a big moment. And of course, I promised her I'd help look out for them. But that was at a huge cost to me.
Yeah.
Because
and
then
the assumption was there.
The assumption was there. And looking back now, and having had counselling and various conversations about it, you know.
Hello. I'm up here on the podcast. The little dogs too.
Yeah, very cute. You know, I know that she should never have put that onto me. It's
probably best intentions, but maybe.
Yeah, and I don't think she ever would have thought that would have impacted me in that way. Yeah. And I didn't even think it had either.
Yeah.
But actually, if I really kind of go back, that probably was the start of me saying, I have to look after other people before myself. And it's been a very long lesson to learn that actually I need to look after myself to be able to look after other people.
Yeah.
Especially as a mum.
It's a classic thing of when you're on an airplane, they say put on the oxygen mask yourself before you help other people. And I think that's a bit of life there. I always think
it's
of that.
A loaded thing they have to do.
Very open countryside here.
We are now,
very
yes.
Flat open countryside. But beside, you know, rain swollen stream, which I hope is full of delightful things.
Yeah, we have had a bit of flooding up here, so
yeah,
this is now going back.
Going back in its box, but it's
well, and you'll see on the OS map here, Virgus, that back in Southmont on the edge, you can see moat, looks like a fortification there. So definitely this water was being used and controlled, wasn't it?
Yeah. When you're out walking, there's this whole thing of. Now we're walking, we're chatting. This is one of the lovely things about a long distance walk. You can just chat away. Do you prefer walking alone or walking with someone? And there's a big flock of starlings now to distract me.
Well, you see, and there you almost answered it, because I think even when you're walking alone, you're not.
Yeah.
In the outdoors, there's always, you know.
Well, that's how I feel. I mean, you know, a lot of people kind of don't really enjoy walking with me because they get really distracted all the time. You hear the starlings going past us.
Really close,
they've got those funny little whack, whack.
But, you know...
Chat of the...
It's funny, though, because... So I normally did solo stuff. And like I said before, the outdoors was definitely an escape. More of an escape than anything else from everything. And then... So being alone was part of that. But then, you know, you reach a point where you're like, it is quite nice to share it with people. And pilgrimages was a way to do that. You know, walking that old way... Mm. Was my first experience of walking with a massive, to me, 20 people, massive group of people with different ideas and conversations, and very difficult to get silence. But I think I needed that. I think I needed to be part. And I say in the book, you know, normally I surprised myself that I decided to camp with everyone, whereas my default would have always been go off on my own, but I almost needed to feel around other people.
That's interesting, because it was quite a big group, and I could feel your evolution. You wrote it really well, that evolution of sort of a loner who's with, not you're a loner, but you know, you like, you clearly less familiar with big groups, and that sense of wanting to be included. I've always been a bit wary myself, just because, I don't know, it's that sustaining conversations over several days.
Yes.
I guess it just happens, and it's easier when you're walking.
Well, and you know, there's a lot of therapy groups out there that do walking therapy, and they say the reason is because you're not looking someone in the face.
Yeah.
It comes out easier when you don't have to look at someone, and you're focusing on your foot placements, and you're almost
with like car journeys.
You're part of your body again. And you know, if walking all these pilgrim paths has taught me anything, it's that people are generally good and generally helpful and warm and kind. And the yes, of course, there are some that aren't. But actually, if we go through life thinking that, which I think at one point I probably did think that,
yes,
it's really damaging to you more than it is to anyone else. And if you can push yourself out of your comfort zone just a little bit, I think the rewards can be absolutely massive to you.
So, we've just walked across rather lovely series of little rivers and
streams
and pasture, and another helicopter. But we've arrived in Brightwell.
Brightwell comes out well, or Brightwell as locals call it.
And there's a pub and it's open.
Yes, let's the Red Lion. Should we go get some lunch?
Another Red Lion. Fantastic. Let's get some lunch. Lunch is on me. So how far have we got left, do you think? Not asking nervously or anything like that.
No, we're definitely over halfway, I'd say. I mean, you may have noticed this about me, Fergus. I'm not the one for the numbers.
We're definitely over halfway, do you think?
Yeah.
Right.
I'm not one for...
I was hoping you were going to say like 9/10 or 11/12.
I'm not in the same way I'm not a list ticker when it comes to like hills. Not really that bothered about the miles I've walked, just what I've done and seen on them.
This might be a really good way of sort of not worrying about how tired you get, because you're not actually keeping...
You just have no idea.
You're not keeping it.
You know, you can be in a certain frame of mind. A short walk can feel very long.
Yes.
And when you're feeling really good and buoyed up, a long walk can feel like nothing at all. So the numbers cease to be less relevant, especially when you're walking a pilgrimage. Because it's about so much more than walking a distance, I think.
So we have just left the road. We left the village.
Yep.
Striding out across pasture, very benign pasture, and you can probably hear lambs bleating. So we've got them, Phoebe.
We got them. Yeah. Must be lunchtime, I think.
Yes. Yeah.
Bit of a stubborn sheep blocking our path here.
Yeah, they do this, don't they? Face off, and then it's...
A sudden run. We hope, not towards us. Yeah. This one's quite a big one.
Big angry face. So we've climbed up from the village. We've reached this fantastic hill fort. Whittenham Clumps, you call it.
Whittenham Clumps.
This is one of the Whittenham.
This is one of the two, the castle one. Which was so that Iron Age.
And right, we're right at the top. Not quite at the top, actually,
the
no.
Top.
There's a whole clump of trees. That'll be the Whittenham Clump.
Yep.
And there's the other one.
So they say that the beech trees on the top of the clumps, some of the oldest planted in England.
Really?
So from the 1740s, they reckon.
So we're getting on for 300 years.
Yeah. This is our Monte de Goya moment. That's Dorchester Abbey.
Oh, that's not far. Oh, that's brilliant. Gosh, I thought it was that distant town over there. Phew.
No.
Ah.
There you go.
I can do that. That's great.
Excellent. And this is to get up to this one, and then we go to the second one for the real view over everywhere. And then we start heading downhill from then. So the last of the climbs.
So the other one isn't a hill fort, is it? Or
I think they think they both were. But this is definitely the fort.
This has got all
definitely the fort.
Amazing ramparts. Just, I love it.
But they had definitely done excavations, and maybe you're right. Maybe they did find more. I'm trying to recall what I read, but... Sure, they found some remains in them, but not loads. But they actually call that top section of trees on top of that one, so not the hill fort, the cuckoo pen.
The cuckoo pen.
So they used to believe that if you could trap a cuckoo up there, you would be guaranteed an everlasting summer.
I wonder if there are any cuckoos here.
I know.
Not
but it's fenced. But you didn't used to be able to get in, but now you can walk through the cuckoo pen.
Oh, okay. The views are staggering up here.
Yeah, suddenly.
You can see out, that's northwestish, I'm imagining. That's.
I can double check for you.
Yeah. So we're going to go to the other clump.
To the other clump. So the other clump where the cuckoo pen is, we'll cut through the cuckoo pen.
Yeah.
Come out the other side, and then you get the best viewpoint.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
I won't wax too lyrical. I won't use up on
Hold up your adjectives until we get up there.
I'm not going to use my lyrical wax. So it's almost like two kind of...
A twin hump. So I had a look into... So obviously we know the Whittenham Clumps, but they did have other names. So the Cynodon Hills was an area this was
Cynodon
often known.
Cynodon Hills, right.
But also these were known as the... Because this used to be Berkshire Bubs. these two.
Barbs.
And then Mother Dunk's Buttocks. And that was apparently a landowner who was around the area, and they called it after her and her bottom.
So we've walked out, oh my goodness, we've walked out of the clump of trees, the old clump of trees,
yeah,
to this. I mean, it's beautiful. What a view, the heart of England. Blossom fluttering past us. Flood water from the Thames.
From the Thames there.
In the valley below. Your church.
So that's Little Wittenham.
Little Wittenham.
So that would be the last church before the mother church of Dorchester Abbey.
Are we going to there next then?
That would be next, yeah. That's the downhill, and then we make our way past the Thames, well, alongside the Thames for a bit, and then over to Dorchester.
Well.
And we came from over that way.
We came from...
Which is it's really lovely and hazy now, isn't it? It's got that lovely blue colour.
It's a really, really sort of... It's chilling out the day. It's just relaxing itself, and it's got the wind out of its system, and it's... We're going to head down to Little Wittenham, and we can see Dorchester, which is about 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 fields. So I'd say that's about a mile.
I think it's a bit longer, but I like your optimism.
Yeah. Descended the hill. It's hard to record while descending. Another gate for the podcast. This is a big, heavy wooden gate. I like this one.
It's a nice one, isn't it?
Solid.
Serious gate. And look how far you've come, Fergus, from that mountain top.
Oh, I thought you meant sort of like spiritually, but yes, it is. We've come down from the mountain, and we're in this gorgeous little village, Little
Wittenham.
Wittenham.
Okay. Yeah.
With like utterly perfect churchyard, beautiful church.
Yeah.
Very well kept church. My goodness.
It is, isn't it?
It's.
You know, maybe the pilgrimage has made that a thing.
Yeah, and I think you get money depending on how many people sign your visitor's book.
Yeah.
We've just done that, fortunately. Lying like a dog. We're really on the homeward stretch now. To Dorchester-on-Thames.
Yep.
A town I don't know at all, so I'm quite looking forward to ticking off a new... I'll never do all of them, but I've done a lot.
You've done a lot and got them done.
So, Phoebe, well, you've been adventuring around the world. I've been 14 years on a UK countryside magazine, so I've seen a lot of Britain. Not as much as I should do, but, you know.
Yeah, it's one of those things that, you know, for all that I've travelled, I do love adventuring around the UK as well, because there is so much here, and there's so much history, and... there's just something special about, we were talking about before about coming home, and I love the way we have the seasons, and
yes.
I love the way things change, you know? Yes. Change and stay the same at the same time.
Some parts of the world you've been in, it's sort of just one season all year round.
One season all the time, and that can get very tedious.
That is strange. I'm not sure I'd know how to live with that. This is the Thames, then? No.
I think it's... Is it this bit? Yes, I think it might be.
This is the Thames, yes. This is a broad river that we're crossing, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh my goodness.
Yes, of course it says the
line. Hello, mighty Thames. How could we... Is this the Thames? What other enormous river would the... Well, that's why there's two arms of it.
We're actually
on an island.
Yeah.
There's a whole community on this island.
Yeah, it's cool, isn't it?
Oh my word. How strange. Living on an island in the Thames. Like, there's
nice,
these two houses here.
Another bridge.
Right, and this will be over the main body
of the
river.
This is the main. Here we go. We're on the island, you see.
So, yeah, we're about to... It's a bit windy because we're going up onto this humpback footbridge.
Yep.
I just think that's incredible to have an island, to live on an island inland.
Yeah. It's quite cool, isn't it?
Yeah. Series of locks.
Lovely view back of the clump. One of the clumps.
The river flowing fast and deep, and a life ring just drifting.
Ominously.
Yeah. And some really sort of formidable looking weirs and locks and things up there. So
yeah, they're serious, aren't they?
So there we go, Dorchester really close now. It looks like we're going on a sort of wildflower meadow walk or something. I don't know if I have a look in it. Thanks.
No worries.
Now that was a painful gate. You can see the floodwater's been up here.
It has, yeah.
Yeah, here we are. We're on the
final
furlong. Yeah, and yeah, you just said how the bells are tolling from. Is it called Dorchester Abbey?
It is, yeah. But I think it's a parish church now.
Right.
Because you know they've all changed, and
yes,
and like I said, you know it's because someone Rich bought it, but it got preserved and not completely destroyed during the Reformation.
Yeah, I see.
So
it survived in some way, although, yeah. In fact, we're passing through this farm, which is big arable fields, but actually I'm right on the edge of the town of Dorchester, but they are planting hedgerows everywhere.
They are.
It's magnificent. I applaud wholeheartedly. It's so nice to see. I mean, really recently planted last year, but, you know, 30 years' time, there'll be a magnificent hedgerow here.
And then we'll just have to come back and work it again, right?
That's true, yeah. I'll be in my late 50s. And there are rooks just in the field beside us, like little... I think they're like little abbots and monks. And
yeah, they do look that
friars,
way.
Rather sort of pompously walking around and prodding the soil to pick out some tasty... invertebrate. But yeah, thank you, this is wonderful. We'll get to the Abbey, but
well, yeah, and the obviously where we started on the Churn Knob was where he convinced the king, like, this is what you want to do. And because of that, that's why Birinus was given Dorchester Abbey, well, the land to build the Abbey, and then from that the town built up. So it's kind of the whole reason it's here. And that's why I think even without being a religious person, you can appreciate, from a historical point of view, the way some of these communities were formed and built up, and have a lot to owe to the pilgrimage, really.
Those bells going, quite some merry tune.
It is. Okay. I feel like this must have felt a little bit what it was like back when the event pilgrimage was on to arrive in Dorchester.
Yeah, well, they've done it just for us.
They have, clearly. Obviously. I arranged this for you, please.
Thank you very much.
There you go.
That is a peal of bells. Just Dorchester Abbey. So we're going to finish here, I think.
Yeah.
The end of our pilgrimage. This is a wonderful building and a beautiful garden around it. I'm feeling a bit lightheaded, I think, mainly because it's just been a lovely day.
I hope it's been enlightening in some way.
Very enlightening. Well, Phoebe, thank you so much for a brilliant day. And the book is called Wayfarer, yeah?
It is, Wayfarer. Love, Loss and Life on Britain's Ancient Paths.
Love, Loss and Life. Gosh, it's all there.
It's all there.
It really felt like the bells were ringing for us as we arrived in Dorchester, which, by the way, is an utterly enchanting little riverside town and really worth a visit if you're in the area. Now, I was incredibly moved and inspired by Phoebe's story, particularly her honesty and her generosity in sharing it with me. Again, she highlights the power of nature, the outdoors, and other people in helping us through our darkest times. And well, I'm sure many of you out there can relate to what she was saying and how nature helps. Her book is brilliant. I genuinely loved it. And it's called Wayfarer, Life, Love and Loss on Britain's Ancient Paths, and is published by Harper North. Well worth a read. Now, you might be hearing I'm accompanied by little Wren, who's also wishing you all well in my garden here. But next week, join me for a wander among the daffodils, the wild daffodils of the Golden Triangle. It's one of Britain's greatest springtime spectacles, and just another magical adventure in nature, which I hope you'll love. And we'll have a roundup of your emails and messages too. For now, thank you so much for listening. This podcast was produced in Bristol by Jack Bateman and Lewis Dobbs, and the music was written and performed by Blair Dunlop. Thanks again, and goodbye.
Take me with you when you